We're going to be talking about finding God in prayer. And in order to sort of set the stage, I'm going to talk a little bit autobiographically for about 5 minutes, and then explain to you why am I all interested in this. And then talk about what I'm going to try to develop over the course of the session is a methodology that we are then going to apply to several prayers, so you get a sense of how to do this. Okay? I grew up in a I had terrific parents. I really lucked out. And it was a typical second-generation American home. So, second-generation Jewish American home. So what that meant was my mother kept a kosher home, but we ate anything out. Well, not quite anything, not human beings.
Although if you went to the right restaurant.
See, that's what philosophy does to you. You can't say a regular sentence. All right, anyway. And when I was 12, I went to JCC day camps until then. I got a half scholarship to Camp Ramah in Wisconsin, which was for 8 weeks. At the time, tuition, this is 1955, tuition at Ramah for 8 weeks was, what would you guess?
$500,
right? Yeah, so I got a half scholarship, and so that was enough for my parents to send me to camp. And at the beginning, it was just a good place to be, because I was learning a lot of Hebrew and had a lot of fun and all of that kind of, and it was away from my parents for the week, and all of that, right? So what that meant was, at the time, in order to go back to camp, you had to be taking at least 6 hours a week of Jewish studies during the year. So what that meant was that, unlike most of my peers, I did not stop taking Jewish studies after my bar mitzvah. So I was still there when I was 15 years of age, at which point Rabbi David McGilner, Alav Shalom, who was the director of the camp, had sessions on Monday evenings, for some reason I remember that, with the machon for the 8 weeks of camp. And he started out by saying, these were all 15 and 16 year olds, how many of you keep kosher at home and not out? And a certain number, how many of you keep kosher at home and out? A certain number of people raised their hands. How many of you keep kosher not at all? And a certain number of people raised their hands. How many of you keep kosher at home but not out? And I was among them, right? And he said, it's you people I don't understand, right? Because we were inconsistent. And then he was on the attack, right? He was basically saying, for the next 8 weeks, why would anybody in his or her right mind believe any of this Jewish stuff or do any of this Jewish stuff? And he started out with very concrete things like Kashrut and Shabbat, and then went to more abstract things like revelation and prayer in God. And I don't remember any of the answers to the questions that were raised. But what was really, really important for me is that here was somebody who clearly was committed to things Jewish. He had devoted his life to it and was not only willing but actually eager to raise all kinds of questions that, if you took them seriously, and he clearly did, they would overturn the entire apple cart, right? In other words, they would undermine all forms of Jewish commitment. That was important for me because much later on, I did a doctorate in philosophy, and as Arthur Danto, one of my philosophy professors, once said, a philosopher is a 5-year-old child who never stopped asking why. That's who I am, right? A rebel at heart. I've got to be able to ask all kinds of questions. I soon came to understand that the questions in life are usually much better than the answers, but still, I have to be able to ask those kinds of questions. Now, from the beginning, and remember that I, not remember, let me tell you that I was I grew up in Milwaukee, not exactly the largest of Jewish communities, no Jewish restaurants whatsoever, no kosher restaurants, I mean, no day schools, so I was in public school throughout my life and very active in all kinds of things, president of the student body in junior high school, president of Future Teachers of America in high school, all of that stuff, right? But what that meant was, getting involved in Jewish life meant was that I had to go against the grain, because it meant, number one, I couldn't go to Friday night basketball games in high school, and that was, to talk about a sin, that was a real sin in my age group. And when I, so basically Dorf checked out at sunset on Friday, and he reappeared, done to sunset on Saturday night, and during the winter when we would go out to do something, and then afterward wanted to go to eat somewhere, well, the new place in town was Big Boy, right? But I didn't get a Big Boy. You know what a Big Boy is? It's a cheeseburger, basically, right? I didn't get a Big Boy. I got a fish sandwich or a salad or something stupid like that. And so I was forever having to try to explain why I had these commitments. I must say that my non-Jewish friends thought it was cool. That was not a problem at all, right? I had this thing, whatever. My Jewish friends, I think, thought that it was medieval. It was, they were very threatened by the whole thing. Now, in explaining myself, certain pieces of it were really easy to explain. Certainly the moral parts of the Jewish tradition are very easy to explain, in the sense that, because one of the things that really attracted me to camp was that we were having conversations about moral issues that were far deeper than anything I had in the city. And in part it was because it's a 24/7 environment, Ramayah is, and so as a result, people do bad things to each other, and so then you start talking about them. And you also talk about things that come out of texts that you study that also raise real moral questions. So that part of the deepening of life was really easy to explain. Even a lot of the rituals. I mean, you sit around at the Shabbat table Friday night with good food and company and singing. I mean, what's there to explain, right? And a number of the holidays are like that. And even prayer. I was davening every day, right? Prayer turns out to be one of the most difficult things to explain. That's another matter, but I'll talk about it in a little while. But never, the whole notion of having a time in one's day in which one gets off the treadmill and tries to focus on what's really important in life, that's pretty easy to explain. What was not at all easy to explain for me was God. Okay? Now, I mean, at that point, and it wasn't, I'm 70, I'll be 71 another month, so this was 1958 when these conversations took place, and in 1958, almost nobody in America was talking about the Holocaust, right? I mean, Night came up, Elie Wiesel's book came out in English in 1961. Richard Rubenstein was the first one to actually try to do some theology about the Holocaust. That was after Auschwitz in 1966. So in 1958, the problems with God were not those problems. The problems were I just didn't see any evidence for God, and I had no idea what to make of God in the first place. It happened that during that summer, I read a little bit of Kaplan, and that was very important for me in terms of understanding the Jewish tradition in historical terms. But I knew that Kaplan was not ultimately going to work for me for two reasons. One, because, God is the power that makes for salvation in Kaplan. And it's a power. It's a power that actualizes your potential for good. So it makes an acorn into an oak tree. It gives you a good idea. It would make Elliot Dorf a good baseball player. That's a power that has yet to manifest itself. But the problem is that I could never try as I might pray to a power. I always had some kind of person in my mind when I was praying. So that was one of the problems that I had with Kaplan. And the other was, for Kaplan, the ritual, because God is the power that makes for salvation, the rituals are folkways. But on Saturday nights at Big Boy, my folk were not observing the rituals, right? And yet I had this sort of sense that there was some kind of authority behind those rituals. And so Kaplan, I knew, was not going to be enough for me, both in terms of the prayer experience and in terms of understanding the authority of rituals, but I had no clue as to what I was going to do with this. Okay? Yet prayer, I was davening every day. Prayer had meanings that were different from the meanings of, you know, irrelevant or at least separate from the whole notions of God. And so through from age 15 to about age 35, if you asked me what I believed about God, I would tell you that, well, I at least believed in Kaplan's God, because you don't have to believe very much to believe in Kaplan's God. You just have to believe that sometimes the acorn becomes the oak tree, right? Not always, sometimes. And some people do, in fact, become good baseball players, right? So you don't have to believe very much in terms of believing Kaplan's God, but I also knew it wasn't sufficient. So remember this, let me tell you that this goes through an undergraduate career with a major in philosophy, rabbinical school, essays for admission to rabbinical school, right? So there was a question about what do you believe about God or something like that. So I talked a lot about covenant, and I talked a lot about the human element of covenant, hoping against hope nobody would ever ask me about the other side of the covenant, right? As it happens, my interview was on Friday afternoon, 2 o'clock in January. Okay, so I walked into the room, and Rabbi Simon Greenberg was the chair of the committee, and he said, well, Elliot, you've been at Ramah for many years. You've been taking courses here, because in order to go back to Ramah as a counselor, I have to be taking 6 hours a week of Jewish studies during the year as well, right? So you've been going to Ramah. You've been taking courses here. I think we know you. Does anybody have any questions? Right? That's how my interview started. There were about two or three questions, and that was the end of it. They all wanted to get home for Shabbat. So, right. So, and then at that time, the process has indeed changed. Yes. At that time, during rabbinical school, the word God was used only when we were quoting a text. We really had no discussions about theology whatsoever. This is the 60s. I was ordained in 1970. Civil rights was on everybody's mind, and Vietnam was on everybody's mind.
What about Heschel?
How do I say this without... Heschel was very much honored for what he did outside the seminary. He was not a good teacher. And except for the seminar that he had on Monday nights. But to get into the seminar, you have to take an exam on 10 books or something like that. And so the people who took that loved him. People like, Arthur Green and Reuven Kimmelman and a few others, right? But the regular course he taught was, it was one year it was supposed to be Maimonides, the other year it was supposed to be on Saadi, I think, or Halevi, and... At least I never had those courses because I was in the Talmud program. But the reputation was that he only taught himself and he came late to class and he didn't, you know, all of that stuff, right? Unfortunately, what happened was at that time when you finished the graduate school of Judaica, it took you 1, 2, or 3 years depending upon how much Talmud you knew when you walked in. Then you had a set of exams, and then in order to get into the graduate rabbinical school. And then there was an interview. So I walked into that interview, and Heschel was the head of my committee. And it was Neil Gilman and David Kogan. And then Neil was the dean of the rabbinical school at the time, and he said, well, congratulations, Mr. Dorfman, passed the exam. So I thought that was that, right? And Heschel pipes up, and he says, Mr. Dorfman, I really cannot imitate him. I have to have a high enough voice for that. I understand you're doing a doctorate in philosophy at Columbia. And I knew what was really in his mind. Why are you not taking my seminar, right? But I was in the Talmud program, and I was doing a doctorate, and I was married, and I had a child. You know, there's a limit. So I said, yes, I'm taking a course. I'm doing a doctorate in philosophy at Columbia. And what is one of your favorite courses? So for some reason, a course I had taken 2 years earlier with Albert Hofstadter on aesthetics came to mind. And I said, well, I had this great course on aesthetics with Albert Hofstadter. And what did you study in that course? Well, we started out with Kant's Critique of Judgment. And what does Kant say about? And then for the next 15 minutes, it was a quiz on Kant's Critique of Judgment, right? Finally, thankfully, David Kogan said, well, Professor, I think we've had enough for the afternoon. We've done what we need to do, right? I frankly felt bad. I didn't want to you know, to insult him in any way, shape, or form. But the fact of the matter is I just had no time for that. But for all the rest of us, we were just not talking about God. So it was only in my mid-30s that I decided I really could not bracket this question anymore. I really have to face, you know, because God is not a small part of the Jewish tradition, in case you didn't look. And so what I decided to do was two things. One, first of all, to use the analytic philosophy background that I had been taught at Columbia to try to figure out what kind of analytic philosophy was being used in philosophy of religion. I did my doctoral dissertation in ethics, not in philosophy of religion. So I did a lot of reading in that. And what then happened was that the book that I ultimately wrote, called Knowing God, Jewish Journeys to the Unknowable, starts out with the story that I just told you, and then the second chapter is about finding God through reason. And I try to talk about, well, what kinds of reasoning processes could you use in order to to at least give grounds for a belief in God. But then the ultimate insight of the book is that after it's all said and done, the Jewish tradition primarily, not exclusively, but primarily describes God as a person. And when we think about persons, I mean, you also get God as a rock, God as a spirit, all stuff, you know, things like that. But the vast majority of Jewish literature, God is, well, frankly, a he, and is very much involved with us. And it's a very theistic tradition rather than a deistic tradition, right? Deism is the belief that God is a creative force. And so Kaplan is a deist. He's one of the few deists in the tradition. Spinoza is another. But the vast majority of the Jewish tradition is theistic, portraying God as a human being. And persons, when we come to know other persons, we don't sort of create a proof for their existence. That's not the way you come to know somebody else. The way you come to know someone else is by doing things with that person and talking with that person. So there's a chapter here on God talking to us, what I understand revelation to mean. There's a chapter on our talking to God in regard to prayer. There's a chapter on God doing things with us, God in history, and the problem of evil. And then there's a chapter on our doing things with God, the life of mitzvot. And then the last chapter is on images of God. That is, how do we, what constitutes a good image and a bad image? What constitutes a true image as opposed to a false image, and things on that order. Okay? So that's what ultimately led to the book. What I'm going to do with you today is that it's part of the stuff in regard to using prayer as a way to come to God. Because what I found out, what I discovered, at least for myself, was that the prayer book was actually a much better way to come to certainly a Jewish understanding of God than the Bible was. Because as soon as you start talking about the Torah, at least, you have to deal with questions of revelation. Where did it come from? And what's the reason? What's the relationship between God and wherever it came from and all of that? But you don't have any of those questions with the prayer book. Because the prayer book, after all, everybody says, was written by human beings. Presumably, and since the prayers use a lot of God talk, presumably the people who were writing those prayers were having some kinds of experiences with God. So the methodology that I devised for myself and that we're going to be using in just a moment is the following. First question to ask of a prayer is, what is the normal everyday experience that the person writing this prayer has had, such that this prayer is a response to that experience? I'm assuming that the people who wrote these prayers were normal, everyday people. They were not on drugs. They were not contemplating their navels on mountaintops, you know, that kind of stuff. They were normal, everyday experiences. They might have been especially talented in articulating those experiences, but they were normal people having normal everyday experiences. So the first question is, what is the normal everyday experience that the person writing this prayer has had? Second question is, Why does he, and I'll say he throughout this now, because most historically, most of the, at least as far as I know, all of the people who wrote the classical prayer book were men. I'm very happy that women are now writing prayers, and by the way, that men are now writing prayers, because one of the pieces of misinformation that we perpetuate by handing out bound volumes like this is that the prayer book is, in fact, a bound volume, when in fact, historically, as you probably all know already, but let me just remind you, historically, you got a... you got an outline of the service, a kind of skeleton of the service, and during the Mishnaic period, and that was filled in over the course of time by a variety of different people who were writing prose and poetry to accompany the blessings, right? And that makes all kinds of sense because you didn't have books altogether. Right? When was the printing press invented? 15th century, that's right, roughly 1450, something like that, okay? So in the ancient world, you didn't have prayer books, and aside from that, you didn't have very many people who knew how to read anyway, right? Why not? Because you didn't have a lot of books. You also did not have a lot of people who had much of an education, right? I mean, you know, girls got no formal education whatsoever until the 20th century, with a few exceptions, but by and large that was the case. And even the one that boys got was not all that great. Fiddler on the Roof more or less had it right. At three, I started Hebrew school. What's the next line? At 10, I learned to pray. That more or less is what it was for my grandparents. Okay. More than any peasant at the time. But certainly not, 10, that's not even the rest of elementary school, let alone junior high school, college, graduate school, all of that. They didn't have that. So the rabbis had a very important question, a very important educational challenge. Namely, how do you convey a tradition to a largely illiterate population who doesn't have books anyway? One of the ways they did that was by the Torah reading that would happen four times a week with explanations, right? So the read in Hebrew and then explained and discussed in whatever the vernacular was. But a much more effective way was through the prayer service. And what they did was create a very small skeleton that included the basic fundamentals of Jewish faith. And specifically, they did that by a system of brachot. By a bracha, I simply mean a one-line thing. Blessed are you, O Lord, who does X. Right? So there are two of those before the Shema, three paragraphs of the Shema, one of those after the Shema. I'm talking about the morning service now. And then 19 of them in the Amidah. So you had 22 lines and three paragraphs. And if you knew those 22 lines and three paragraphs, you could pray as a Jew. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that what the rabbis did in those 22 lines and three paragraphs is that they put into them their understanding of what Jewish belief about God is all about. It's the closest thing that we Jews ever get to an official creed. You know, during the Middle Ages, there were a number of times in which various Jews, probably Rambam most famously, tried to create a creed for Jews. But you know what happens as soon as Jews do that, right? Rambam said 13. You know, Kreska said I can do it in 6. Albo said I can do it in 3. Right? You know, all of that stuff, right? And none of them really became authoritative in the way that Matveya HaTfilah became authoritative. And so what I'm going to suggest to you is that what we have in the prayer book is as close as we get to a handbook on Jewish theology for Jews that is official in any way, shape, or form. You know, as you probably know, the Christian tradition is very creedal, and so is the Muslim tradition. If you don't believe that Muhammad, that God is one and that Muhammad is his primary prophet, you can't be a Muslim. If you don't believe that Jesus is Christ in some form or another, you can't be a Christian. But we don't have anything like that. We certainly have central beliefs. You know, God, Torah, Israel is a pretty good summary of them. But we certainly have some central beliefs, but we have immense differences as to how to understand them. Louis Jacob wrote this wonderful book called Principles of Jewish Belief, in which he took Maimonides' 13 principles, and all he did was catalog all of the various interpretations among rabbis of each of the 13 after Maimonides, right? So for Adonai Echad, 32 different understandings of those two words. This is the Jewish tradition, ladies and gentlemen. So the thing is that, what I'm suggesting to you is that Matvei HaTfilah is the closest that we ever get to an official creed. So if I want to find out about God, and in particular, if I want to find out about a Jewish understanding of God, this is the text. Right? So what the second question is then, the first question is, what did the author of the prayer just experience? Second question is, why does the author of the prayer describe this experience using God language? Why does the author of prayer just say, it happened, or something, or maybe poetically, it happened, right? Why does the author of the prayer use God language, and what does he mean by God in using God language? And then the third question is, does it make any sense for us now in the 21st century to use God language to describe that experience as well? Or given modern science, philosophy, and all of that, is, you know, that was then, this is now. Right? Or does it make any sense for somebody with, you know, with a contemporary background in the sciences and philosophy and everything else to use God language for those experiences? All right? So what we're going to do is look at hopefully two prayers, maybe three. We'll see how far we go in terms of finding God in prayer. I'm going to start with Ma'ariv simply because, as you know, but let me just remind you, the prayers surrounding the brachot in Ma'ariv are shorter than the prayers in Shacharit.
Baruch Hashem,
right? Why do you think they're shorter? You want to get home. You're tired. Of course, in the morning, you have to get to work.
Yeah, but they didn't have light.
Didn't have light. That's right. So there was less that they could get people to remember. And by the way, what that meant, what all of this meant before the prayer book, was that the really hard job was that of the chazan. Right? Because whoever was leading the prayers had to fill in...
Say that in a cancer's assembly.
Okay, fair enough. Had to fill in whatever prose or poetry he was going to use in order to articulate the idea of the bracha more fully. But it's hard. Have you ever tried to write a prayer? How many of you have tried to write a prayer? Okay. What makes it difficult? Yes.
Well, part of what makes it difficult is how loud the language, the stayed language, established language of the Siddur is in,
right,
in our heads. It is so damn hard to get away from
from
the O Lord formulation.
Okay. So one problem is just simply, how do you articulate something that's prayer when you have all of this competition? Okay, right? Why do that? Yes, go ahead. Another. Please tell me your name. I'm sorry.
I'm Shira Wallach.
Hi.
And if I'm writing a prayer, it's meaningful for me, but I'm writing it for the occasion to share with
my
community.
There you go. How do you write a
prayer?
Right on. A prayer. If you write a prayer, it's fine for me. But how do you write a prayer for the masses, let alone for the ages? Right? What's another problem in writing prayer? Yes.
The Keva Kavana debate. We have a vast tradition of Keva that we can use.
Right.
You know, being spontaneous and actually writing something that we often try to bookend with the Keva so that we at least feel like we're having the Chatimah that makes us feel connected to it,
yes,
rather than go off and doing something else.
That's right. And already, I mean, our services are not short, okay? I mean, although I have to tell you, I spent a weekend with evangelical leaders about stem cell research, and during one of the breaks, I don't know how it came up, I said to one of them, the best thing you guys have going for you is a one-hour service, because how bad could it be? And he said to me, trust me, it could be really bad. So, all right, anyway, what's another problem in writing a prayer? Yes.
Similarly on the the prayer being or a reflection of that, my immediate experience that I have to commit myself towards that, and that it bounds me off from future, future reflection or change on that, but it's a statement that has to be made.
That's right. And when and how do I know that anybody else is going to agree with that statement? How many for them to even understand that statement? Right, all of that. And then, of course, classical Jewish prayers are in Hebrew, which is not the native language of most Jews through the centuries. Right? So are you going to write it in your native language? Are you going to write it in Hebrew? And, you know, all of that. So it took... Yes, go ahead, Steve.
Well, the authenticity is, I guess, a related question.
Right.
Many of the prayers create their authenticity by citing biblical phrases and passages.
That's right. But could you create a prayer? I mean, presumably, at least logically, you could create a prayer that is clearly not Jewish. Now, obviously, you say, in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord, that's going to be pretty good, right? But the question is, are there other kinds of prayers that are not as obviously not Jewish that at least stretch the boundaries as to what is acceptable within Judaism? And precisely because we don't are not a creedal religion, answering that question is really hard. Okay? So, are there boundaries to what's an acceptable prayer? So what happened was that over the course of the centuries, some people wrote prayers, and some of them became popular. And so by the time that you get to the printing press, what you get is what the prayers that had become popular were. And sometimes there were two of them. And so one way the Siddur did that was by having one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Like, for example, Shalom Rav and Sim Shalom, or Ahava Rabbah and Ahavat Olam, right?
For them both, Modin.
So you, and then another way to do it is to say one is more prominent than the other. So that's what happens with Modin,
right?
So you only do it silently, okay? And then of course you get a variety of different nuschaot. I didn't realize exactly how unbound this prayer book was until my father died, and I went the days I was teaching classes, I went to the university to daven with the students. But the days I was not, I went to my synagogue, Beth Am. And at the time, this was the mid 1980s, you still had a lot of old men from Europe. And what you heard on any given morning depended upon the particular shtetl from which that particular man came. Right, I still remember Mr. Eisenberg was from Hungary, and there were at least five extra lines in the service when he died, and it was Toira Oira, okay. And on the other hand, when the variations among the prayers among were considerably more than what you probably have in mind in our among our holy ancestors in Europe, okay. Okay, so let's take a look at the first paragraph of Ma'ariv. I'm on page 37 in this prayer book. So I don't know if some of you don't have it. Maybe if you could, some of you that are next to each other could share. Does anybody not have a prayer book there?
We have iPads.
You have iPads. Fine, whatever you have. Okay? So what I'd like you to do is read the paragraph to yourself for a moment with those three questions in mind. Number one, what is the experience that the author of this prayer has just had? Number two, why is he using God talk and what does he mean by God? And three, it doesn't make any sense for us to use God talk about this as well. I'm going to give you a minute or so to think about those things. What's the experience that he had? Yes?
The day is getting, is ending, it's getting dark.
The sunset.
We're not creatures of the night. We don't function as well at night. So it's telling us that the God that watches out for us by day is watching out for us at night.
Okay, so, but the experience is the sunset, right? It's night. Which I would hope that you would say is a normal everyday experience, right? Okay. Now, what is he saying about it? Asher b'dvaro ma'ariv aravim. Why does he say that it was that this that, sun, that the evening came because of his word? What do you think he has in mind? Yes.
Creation.
administration.
That's right. He probably has Genesis 1 in mind, right? But through God's word, the evening comes. V'chachma potach sharim. Now here I have to explain something to you. In the ancient cosmology, the world was flat. Okay? On top of this flat earth, you had a dome. Right? Why do you think they thought that there was a dome on top? Not yet, because when you look up at the sky, what does it look like?
Blue.
Well, it might look blue, it might look gray, whatever, right? But it looks like a dome. Why does it look like, we now know why it looks like a dome. Why does it look that way? Because of the curvature of the earth. Okay? But in any case, they didn't know that, because the world was flat, so there's a dome. That's called in Hebrew? Rakia. Right. Now, on top of the dome is what?
Water.
And the reason why you know that there's water is because sometimes it rains. And so there are, as you have it in the Noah story, Arubot HaShemayim. What are Arubot HaShemayim? They are little openings. So it's as if this Rakia is like a sieve, which can be closed, those are sunny days, or open, and those are rainy days. Okay? So on top of it, you have water on top of the dome, right? And then underneath of the earth, what do you have?
Water.
How do you know you have water?
Because
of wells. That's right. When you dig down, you get wells. Also springs, right? So there's water underneath. You have a flat earth. You have the dome. And then the stars and that kind of stuff are where? Hanging within the dome, right? Because you see it. Now, what's the question is, how do you explain the fact that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? Well, they had a way to do it, right? It rises in the east. Well, here, let me do it this way. If this is east, then that's west, okay? So it rises in the east, it goes around the dome, and then what happens? Then it disappears, right? So the way that they understood how it disappeared was that it goes on top of the dome, that's nighttime, and that's how it gets back here to rise again in the east. Right here, and right here are the gates of heaven. And you thought it was a metaphor. Okay, right? But those are the gates of heaven. That's the literal cosmology of the ancient world, right? So with wisdom, he opens the gates of heaven so that the sun can leave and there be nightfall. And with understanding, and then it reminds him, one order of nature reminds him of another order of nature, namely changing this, because remember, this is all associative, this is all oral, so it's associative reasoning. And that reminds him of, changes the seasons, Machaliva is my name, more or less similar, and then changes and orders the stars in the sky. Astronomy was one of two sciences that the ancients knew quite well. What was the other science that they knew quite well? Anatomy. Why did they know anatomy very well? Well, because they slaughtered animals, okay? And to a certain extent, they tried to do some medicine, okay? So anatomy, they had at least a fairly good understanding of. And astronomy, why do they have a good understanding of astronomy? Well, first of all, they didn't have lights. They didn't have television. They didn't have computers. They didn't have any distractions, right? And so they really saw the stars. And they needed to understand the stars for what purpose?
Navigation.
Exactly right. Okay? So they were curious about the stars, and they had a sense of there being an order of the way that the stars worked. Okay? So order of day and night reminds them of the order of the seasons, reminds them of the orders of the stars in their watches. Barakia, the stars are in the dome. Kirtano, according to his will. Then he goes back to what started the whole thing. He creates day and night. Golel. Now you understand the word Golel. What does Golel mean?
Rolled,
because he rolls it around the dome. And the dome is circular, right? So he rolls it. Right? The light before the darkness, the darkness before the light, and he changes day into night and distinguishes between them. Now watch this next line. Adonai Tzvaot Shema. God is the God of hosts, as it's sometimes called, armies, right? What does that mean?
Stars.
Well, that all of the entire Hamalya Shamala, right? God is the God of power. right? Because God has this whole retinue of stars and sun and moon and all of that, right? That's the army that God has. That is the God of God is a powerful God. Now watch this line. El Chai V'Kayam, everlasting God. Tamid Imloch Aleinu Le'olam V'Yad. Give me, you know what the words mean. Give me two translations of Yimloch. He will rule. In which case, what is that last line a statement of? There's a future and it's a statement of?
Submission to God's will.
Well, it's a statement of faith, right? God will rule over us forever and ever, right? Or it could be not he will rule, but
may he rule,
yeah. Right? A statement, it could be a jussive verb, right? That is a verb saying a hope. And why would he hope? Why would the author of this prayer hope that God will rule over us forever and ever? Because if these orders of nature do not in fact work, now here comes a philosophical, technical term, we are of sorts, okay? Right? I mean, he had a sense that our very existence depends upon these orders of nature. So the last line may be simply a statement of faith, or it may be a statement of hope. Baruch atah ma'ariv ha'arazim. Okay, so our second question. What kind of a God is he talking about, first of all? He tells you in this verse, in this paragraph. Well, it's a God of Tzva'ot. It's a God of power. And why do you think he's talking about this God as being a God of power? It could be because it's night and it's scary, but it also could be...
He's in awe of the sun.
That's right. He's in awe of the fact that... In awe of the fact that these things happen. And he's aware of the fact that he doesn't have the ability to make them happen or to change how they happen. Right? So the God that he's talking about is very much Kaplan's God, actually. The God that he's talking about is a God that of power that makes these things happen. Okay? And why is he talking God talk? Because he can't do it. Right? So he's attributing the fact that these things happen to powers beyond himself. All right. Now then, the third question. Does it make any sense for us in the 21st century, knowing science and the like, to use God talk for it as well? Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to answer your question, but in answering that, I'm afraid I may undermine your first two questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, I think the simple answer is no, right? Because our understanding of science is evolved.
Absolutely.
And therefore, this beautiful description that you just gave us as neuralistic is a 21st century person because they understand the world. Way.
Right.
So then, in order to make this prayer relevant, I have to ignore questions 1 and 2. At least I think so. Mm-hmm. It's not so important what the person had in mind when he or she wrote the prayer. I don't care about that person. I care what I have in mind when I read the prayer.
Right.
Right. And when I read this prayer, for example, I might think contrasting things. I may think, on the one hand, the day is over, thank God.
Right.
Or I might think, the day is over, there aren't enough hours in the day.
Right.
In both cases, I say to myself, God, you're in control of the fact that the day is over, so I have to let go of either one of those two things.
Okay, well, let me take your first point, because it's absolutely critical. It is clear to everybody, I would imagine, in the room, that our cosmology is not this cosmology, right? We are after Copernicus, after all. Okay? So, the question then becomes... Does that then make, let me take your I'm going to go further than you probably would want to go, all right? But I might as well play McGillner here. Does that then mean that we should throw it out? Right? Let's start all over again with a prayer about night. If we want to have a prayer about night, let's start all over again with a prayer about night that reflects post-Copernican cosmology.
Right? Well, I'm not suggesting better.
I know. I said I was going to go beyond you, right? Okay. I mean, but if you to take your point really seriously, then at least that's an option, right? Strike out this prayer because it's based on old science, and we have different kinds of science now. We won't talk about gates of heaven or anything like that, right? And we won't worry about whether God will rule over us in order to make these things happen, because our kind of science means that it'll happen all the time anyway, right? Without the will of God to intervene. So if I'm going to take your point really seriously, at least one option would be to start all over again. All right? Why not? Let's take this point really seriously. Go ahead. Yes.
I don't think it's the task of tefillah to report what we know from science.
Right.
And fit God into that picture.
Okay.
I don't think that's the task of tefillah.
Right. And so, and how do you know, let me how do you know that that wasn't even what the liturgist had in mind? What is the tone of this prayer? Is this like a scientific report?
No. Certainly, yeah, it's just thought.
Certainly not.
Yeah.
It's a description of a sense of awe. Exactly right. So then the question becomes a very different one, doesn't it? The question becomes, if you had a prayer that was based on a science that's not your own, but whose purpose was not to teach you science, its purpose was to teach you awe, or at least to express awe, then the question becomes, regardless of the science, can you read this prayer in a way that still stimulates awe in you about the fact that there is day and night, order of the stars and the seasons? Right? Then the question becomes not a scientific question. The question becomes a question of the question of effectiveness of communicating awe. That's really where the game gets played. Are you following this?
Yeah.
Right? So then the real question is, for my number three question then becomes, does it make any sense for us with modern science to use this prayer to talk about God?
Yes.
It may or may not. I mean, for me it does, okay? I don't mind, I mean, because it really does call attention to the fact that city slicker than I am, that I nevertheless am part of this larger part of nature, and even Kant thought it was awesome, right? Even Kant, who thought that the argument from design couldn't work, argument for God based upon design couldn't work, nevertheless said, still, it is really awesome to see the stars in the heavens above. Right? Yes, Dan.
So when I was thinking, I had this revelation about, you know, Sir Hava wrote in Bahar Enea. Sent in school one day, lunch out this morning, get kicked out of junior congregation because I'm too old, and I'm hot to get around because I love shopping. And I didn't believe much. I was never a believer after I was about 10. And I said, oh my God, these rabbis are so smart. Mm-hmm. This Baha'i Erein, you know, I know what it is. It's a light of Torah. And Yosher HaMa'orot is what I'm seeing in the world. And it changed my life. Because it made me understand that I don't have to believe it in that way.
Right.
And I can still pray to God. And I believe strongly praying to God, even though I have a very non-fundamentalist belief in God. But what struck me was that these ordinary, I thought they were ordinary people who were very smart. And they managed to create images for me that really resounded to my attachment to the Jewish people. So when I doubt a diary and I say these tefillot, I'm about the woman, and you know, and I understand about Abba Olam and Abba Rabba. I think about my connection to the people who wrote.
Okay, but then the question, fair enough, but then the question becomes, right, I mean, what you have to ask yourself is, what's the purpose of writing this prayer in the first place and of saying it, right? And if the purpose of saying it is only to connect you to the Jewish people, then you have to still ask yourself, right, well, does every prayer work that way, right? Or does, you know, are some of them better at that than others? I mean, you have to start talking about the goals of prayer to begin with, right? That's a whole other thing. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that prayer is the most complex piece of the Jewish tradition to understand. It is much, much easier, as I found out when I was a teenager, to explain why Judaism is relevant to morality, or why most of the rituals of Judaism. You can sort of read off their meanings pretty clearly. But with prayer, you've got, first of all, a lot of misconceptions about prayer. Most people think that prayer means you ask for something, and then if you get it, it worked. If you don't get it, you know, it didn't work. By the way, if you have not, I like country music, but if you've not heard Garth Brooks' song, Unanswered Prayers, you must hear that. And by the way, Brad Paisley has a wonderful one as well called No. All right? It's worth it to Right, I'll leave it at that, okay? But the first question is, what are you doing when you are praying? So you start out with misconceptions that prayer means petitioning for something and getting it. But then if you look, and by the way, English is really deceptive because English is a Christian language. It was created by Christians. Still to this day, the vast majority of people who speak it as their native language are Christians. And so you shouldn't be surprised if English words have a lot of Christian connotations. Certainly true for Messiah, salvation, that kind of stuff. Even sin. But also prayer. Do this, I pray. What does that mean in English? I ask. And so the English word prayer leads you to believe that prayer is about asking for things. And then you open up the Siddur, and there are prayers of petition, but the vast majority of them, of the prayers in the Siddur are?
Affirmation.
Yes, affirmation of God, awe of God, praise of God, thanks to God, a little confession, right? By the way, a very little confession compared to Luther's prayers, but anyway. Okay, and so the very English word misleads you as to what prayer is all about. What is prayer about? What does lechit palel mean? It's not really self-judgment. It's actually, as Rabbi David Lieber, Lev Shalom, told me, it's actually to put yourself up for judgment. Right? It's to put yourself in the context of where you are seeing the world through God's eyes. That's really what's going on in prayer. Right? What you're supposed to be doing is seeing the world through God's eyes. And in that way, you're seeing whatever your faults are as well as whatever your strengths are. Yes, go ahead.
So for me, the first paragraph is a very humanist, universal prayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Jewish. It
could be anything.
It could be anything. Well, to me, I would actually rewrite it because of the science we know, in the sense of when you look up at the stars and you know that there's this whole universe out there, and thinking how large it is and how small you are, that's like a very scary thing to think about. And you only really sense that at night.
Where do you get scary in Maariv? Ashkivenu, of course. That's right. As a matter of fact, one of the things I did with our rabbinical students a long time ago when I was dean was take them, we were up at Ramah for 2 days for a retreat, and at night I had them write down all of their associations with night. One or two word phrases, right? About half of the associations were scary, right? And the other half of the associations with night were? What?
Mischievous.
No, that's a part of scary. No, calm, sleep, right? Enveloping, you know, that kind of thing, right? And then what we did was we went around a path in camp where there's not a lot of lighting so that you actually felt night, right? Silently. To feel, and then we studied Hashkivenu. Okay? Yes.
Scary was the right word, but it's more an existential.
Yes, it is.
No, I don't mean like I'm scared that you're going to die. What I mean is to say, the stars I'm looking at could have burnt out, 100 million years ago.
Yes, that's right.
And I only am living this long, and to think about what is my luck, what is the purpose of my life, does it have a purpose, that in that way.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I would say to you, if you're using modern science, don't worry about the stars. Worry about global warming.
Right.
But that's another matter. Okay. Let's do let's do another one simply because I want to show you a different where it's harder. Because I think you're absolutely right. I think even Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator. Because all the founding fathers were deists. They were not theists. They believed in a creative force. They did not believe in a personal God. Okay? So I think even Thomas Jefferson might be able to say this prayer. But let's take a look at the next one. Again, look at it with the three questions in mind. Next one, Ahavat Olam. Now, I'm going to have to stop you because we only have about 4 minutes left. This is harder already. Okay? What do you think the experience of the author was that led him to write this prayer? What was he doing or what was happening in his life?
Connecting with
connecting with us. Judaism is his way of life.
Connecting with?
Mitzvot means halakha.
Okay, he was connecting somehow or another with mitzvot and halakha. What's one possible way he was doing it?
Study.
Yes, possibly he was just studying. Or it's possible he was just doing a mitzvah in one form or another. Okay? Because that's what he's talking about. So he was having one or another, let's say those two experiences. There might be a few others. But it was either that he was studying the Torah or he was doing a mitzvah of one form or another. And what does he and what does he say about that experience? How does he experience that? Does he experience it as all mitzvot?
No.
That's right. He experiences it as a real gift, and he's very happy about it. He certainly doesn't. You know, there are expressions in our tradition about the burden of the commandments, right? But this is not that by a long shot. This is the other end of things, right? Where he's really happy to have the mitzvah. Okay. Now, why does he associate? Why does he use God language? Why isn't it just say there was J, E, P, and D, and we got the mitzvot, right? Why does he use God language, do you think?
I think it's the Dr. Finkelstein moment where, you know, if I want to talk to God, I open the siddur, but if I want God to talk to me, I open the Chumash or I open the Shas or something.
Okay.
When I'm studying, I experience God's presence through the written word or the revelation.
Okay. Well, he might, as a result of studying or of doing the mitzvah, have a sense of God through it, right? He might do it without that sense at all. Okay? But on the other hand, he might have experienced God in the process of doing the mitzvah. I mean, it's sort of like Ron Wilson and Larry Hoffman put together what was then first called Synagogue 2000, now Synagogue 3000. Anyway, in the first meeting that we had of, I was helping with it, in the first meeting that we had of representatives of 16 synagogues, 8 conservative, 8 reform, one of the things that came out was, it was a week long, it was about 5 days at Ramah. One of the reform rabbis involved told us a story about the fact that he had a group of people in his synagogue work on a building for Habitat for Humanity. And he thought that in the evenings people would just want to veg out. Nothing doing. What they wanted was Jewish text to give Jewish meaning for this mitzvah, for doing the mitzvah. What they wanted was a connection to God and their tradition to make what they were doing during the daytime meaningful, right? Jewishly meaningful. So you could understand Habitat for Humanity simply on humanistic terms, but you could make it Jewish, and that's what his Reform congregants wanted. Okay, so it's possible that what happened here was either in the process of study or in the process of doing a mitzvah, the author of this prayer believed that that God was involved. Why does he think, if it's mitzvot, right, why not? Just, I mean, why does he not say, isn't it great that J.E.P. and D did their thing? Joel, did you want to? Yeah.
I think that this is magnificently integrative. It's expressing a beautifully integrative moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's about God present in the words of the Torah, which are instantiated through his performance of the mitzvah.
Right.
And that there's a unity there. In the performance, he is instantiating words which come directly from God, and that's the significance of Bahem Ne'egeyo Ma'avara.
Okay.
And other phrases.
Right. So I think you're absolutely right. I think one very plausible way of reading this prayer is exactly what Joel just said. Right? He has this experience, and it is part and parcel of that experience. Another possible way, at least, of reading this prayer is that he's talking God talk because... Yes?
It reminds me of the passage in Deuteronomy that says... What other nation has laws so beautiful as this that they have
good. Good. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Right? So another plausible reading of this is that he's thanking God for this because he realizes that other nations who created their own law codes didn't create nearly as wise ones. That's a bad English sense. And there are law codes that were nearly as wise, right? My mother was an English teacher, that's why. Like philosophy and English, my God. All right. It's a wonder I say a word at all. Okay, yes. So the thing is, so both of those are at least two possible reasons why he's invoking God. Now notice, just I'm going to have to, Yeah, just because we have to stop soon. What kind of a God is he talking about here?
A loving God,
and therefore clearly not a deistic God. This is very clearly a theistic God, right? And it's a God who also is able to give you, right, these commandments that one rejoices in, and that are going to be our lives and the length of our days. Right? So this is a God who is not only loving, but a God who is also pretty smart and pretty wise in terms of being able to craft laws that one can use for the length of one's life. Right? I don't know who was first. Miranda, go ahead.
The love goes both ways. God loved us enough to give us the law, and we love God enough to keep it.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a full circle of love.
That's right. But exactly right. And notice that it's Oheva Mo Yisrael is the Chatima. Right? God loves his people Israel. How does God love his people Israel? By giving us commandments. Now, what I would suggest to you is that this is very plausible, but also a very Jewish kind of thing. Right? The rabbis very often are reticent to talk about, and on the pulpit especially, God loves us. Right? Why are rabbis reticent to say God? Because it's so Christian, right? But here you have it straight out, right? In the bracha, no less. Right? This is not the later added prose. In the bracha, no less, you have God loves us. Okay? Now, how does God love us? What I'd suggest to you is that the way to think about this is parents and children. Okay? When, clearly, what you want in terms of good parenting is reasonable rules reasonably applied, right? Because if they are arbitrarily applied, right, then you get child abuse, okay? But on the other hand, if parents don't have any rules for their kids, how do the children experience that? They don't care about me. It's apathy. It's not love. And so basically what you want is, in good parenting, is that there are reasonable rules for the particular child, the particular age, and all of that, reasonably applied. It's part of the reason why the teenage years are so difficult, because how do you gauge what is reasonable at what age for what child and all of that, right? But the point is that it's an act of love that we have these commandments, because we experience God's love by virtue of the fact that there are rules of the game, right, that help us figure out how to be a good person. So that's, I think, part of the reason why he's speaking God talk. Then the third question is, does it make any sense for us? Well, I leave that to you. It's a question of, do you see the mitzvot in either of the two ways that we were just talking about? Do you see the mitzvot as part of the integrative experience of God, along the lines that Joel was talking about, right? Or do you see the mitzvot as a better way of living than other kinds of cultures? Right, I you may not like that, okay? Maybe worried about Asher b'charvanu and all of that, right? But what I would ask you to think about is, and there's no slam dunk answer to this. To what extent is a Jewish understanding of morality and what the goals of life are? To what extent, first of all, what is that understanding? How is it distinct from, and how is it like, Christian understandings, Muslim understandings, Buddhist understandings, humanistic understandings, Marxist understandings, right? Take all of the various, both secular and religious theories in the world, and understand that they are very different. Yeah, it's all human beings, but all you have to do is think about who's the ideal person in each one of these various ways of thinking about things, and you get very different answers to that. For example, is the ideal person married? There are religions in the world in which the ideal person is not married. Give me an example. Catholic Catholicism, Buddhism also, by the way. Buddhist monks are not married, right? Whereas, when I was in rabbinical school, it was all men, and we were told that we'd better get married while we were in rabbinical school, because if not, the very first year we were out, the sisterhood would make sure that we were married. So if we want any choice in the matter, we'd better do it now, right? Very different way of understanding. That doesn't mean that single people are not created in the image of God. Of course they are. right? But the and but the point that I'm after here is that what the tradition wants is marriage and children to the extent that one can get it. Is the ideal person educated? There are traditions in the world in which the primary tenets of the religion are only in the hands of the elite, and they're secret. Give me some examples of that. The Druze, the Mormons, right? The Buddhists, right? Whereas what happened in the Catholics until the Second Vatican Council, there was, as a matter of fact, that was 1965. In 1962, I was rooming with a Catholic fellow, and he found out during our sophomore year that the books that we were required to read in the freshman year as part of required courses at Columbia for a freshman, some of those books were on the index. So I stood up with him one night to help prepare him for going to confession the next year, or the next day, for having read those books, right? So when he came back the next day, I said, well, how did it go? So he said, well, I found out that at least in my tradition, forgiveness is easier to get than permission. But the point is that it's a, yeah, I mean, whereas in our tradition, what happens? Deuteronomy 31. Once every 7 years, men, women, and children have to hear the Torah. Yes, we try not to, right? Have to hear the Torah read and explained. Very different understanding of who the ideal person is. So part of the question is, I'm not asking you an empty question. Part of the question is, if you understand this, this paragraph is saying, he's happy about the mitzvot, not only because he experiences God in them, but because he really does think it's a better way of living than the others that are around.
And also this forever, not only the love of God for us, but our love for the mitzvot le'olam.
Yes, that this is going to be what Randy was saying before, this is going to be a mutual love affair. Yeah. Anyway, as you can see, I mean, what I was trying to do with the second one is they show you that as you go through these, you're not going to be as easy as the creation stuff. But if you go through the Amidah, right, go paragraph by paragraph, and by the way, the three paragraphs of the Shema as well, and Gaal Yisrael, right? If you go through those and ask those three questions, what I would suggest to you is that you'd be able to, at least for me, it was helpful to create a theology that I could believe in, which I finally put into this book. The book sells on Amazon for $51. I can give it to you for $40 if you want. Okay, thank you.